You are listening to the Dan Patrick Show on Fox Sports Radio.
NBA playoffs feel like they've been going on a long time. Remember when Kevin Durant's tippy toes were on the three-point line in that Nets-Bucks series? That feels like last season, doesn't it? Or when LeBron was still in the playoffs. Now, the only playoffs he's in, battling aliens in Space Jam. I did watch the movie last night. I know it's not meant for me. I'm not the target demo. And I was a little bit surprised because LeBron's a villain. And then his son is in the movie. And I just had a hard time kind of understanding. It felt like life's lessons and you wanted to. I just wanted a damn cartoon. I just wanted to have something that was pretty breezy there. A little deeper than I thought. But and I'm not going to compare, you know, LeBron to Michael in the Space Jam.
Better actor?
Michael, obviously. But I did watch it a little bit. It just wasn't as breezy as I thought. That's the word. I kept going, man, I'd like this to be a little more lighthearted here. It was heavier than what I thought. Would I recommend it? Yes. Yeah, for somebody who is 14 and under, yeah, you would probably get a kick out of it. Now, maybe as if you're a parent, you might be watching and maybe you take away some life's lessons there, but it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. Let's put it that way. Yeah, Paulie.
I'm just guessing here, but I bet LeBron's team wins.
I don't want to spoil anything.
My bad.
I don't want to spoil it. I know that, hey, I know he won at the box office. Because there are a lot of people on social media like, let's see what you do against Black Widow. And then all of a sudden you go, the number one movie in America is Space Jam, not Black Widow anymore. So you think back when LeBron was in the playoffs. How about Ben Simmons passing up that dunk opportunity against the Atlanta Hawks? Or Paul George was actually playoff P? And did the Hawks actually make it to the conference finals, or was that a dream? So this has been a long, strange trip in the postseason. Two games left, maybe. Maybe it ends tonight. The drama of the series has been great, and hopefully we get a few more memorable moments before it's all said and done. The long, strange playoff road finally reaches its conclusion. And you start to think about NBA Finals. And having covered quite a few of them, you would always, it felt like, remember the moments made by the winning team. What's Phoenix's signature moment so far? Exactly. Milwaukee, got a couple of them. You know, Drew Holiday, the steal, the alley-oop to Giannis, Giannis with the block. Like, they got a couple of them. And normally that team wins a championship. And you get this feeling that this is it. There's going to be 60,000 fans outside the arena in Milwaukee. It feels like they're going to have a parade tonight if Milwaukee wins and wins its second NBA championship in the first in 50 years. But if they don't win, can't imagine what that 60,000 is going to feel like outside the building as the series will then head back to Phoenix. But we will approach tonight's game six with John Barry coming up next hour. Poll question, who's doing the honors today, Paulie?
If you were a Milwaukee Bucks fan who had tickets to game six at home tonight and you could sign a deal. The Bucks lose tonight but win in seven games and your team wins the NBA title, or you go tonight and you roll the dice with whatever happens in game six and seven.
Ooh.
So you're guaranteeing yourself a victory, mm-hmm. but it's not going to be in the game you're at. To put this in perspective, I went to game three and four of the Cubs World Series in Chicago. They lost both games. But they don't feel that bad because it doesn't bother me now. But those two nights were two rough nights.
Oh, you're a mess. Paulie doesn't get emotional. Oh. I thought, God, I got it. This guy's going to cry.
After game four in Chicago, there was no public transportation. You had to walk like eight blocks. It was like a walk of drunken zombies who were upset about
it. It was a walk in shame.
Oh,
walk of shame.
It was.
Yeah.
But if you could sign that deal, if you're a Bucks fan.
I would go to game six. And just expect us to win. I think the last time they lost was to the Atlanta Hawks in the playoffs at home. I would roll the dice. Now, Phoenix has been good on the road, but I would roll the dice there and say, we got momentum. We're going to sweep them. Lost the first two. We're going to win the next four. Yeah, see.
Got to roll the dice.
Yeah.
To be there in that atmosphere, if they win game six and you were there, got to roll the dice.
Any other poll questions, suggestions?
I have one. If I would have told you a week ago that Eli Manning would work in the media someday, your answer would have been, sure, maybe, no chance in hell.
Well, I thought that he was going to work with the Giants.
He has a role with the Giants. It's like a business development type role.
Yeah. But as far as a standalone media member where he's another analyst, like Tony Romo, the answer is no. But now he's going to pair up with his brother, and they're going to do Monday Night Football. It's great business by Eli and Peyton. And Peyton's saying to ESPN, I don't want to work for you. I want to work with you. And that's where you own things, and then ESPN will then rent those things, buy those things. You already have Peyton's places. Do you realize that he's got other athletes that are going to be doing, like Poppy, Big Poppy's going to do Poppy's places. Abby Wambach is going to do Abby's places. He's creating this, I don't know if it's a series of these shows. I don't even know how to describe it, but he's branching out where he's probably going to executive produce these shows. Yeah, Seton.
But he's kind of taking the model that Kobe had already started. He, you know, Details is a Kobe Bryant show. You know, he was already selling content to ESPN and probably other providers or other places. So it's sort of just an extension of that.
And then you wonder, because when you start to think of this decision, that I kept waiting for Peyton, if he was going to do Monday Night Football or somebody else was going to reach out to him, if Troy Aikman went into the front office for a football team and Peyton decided he was going to do Fox, then you realize that even the numbers where I was talking to a TV exec, and you could get some pretty good numbers, you weren't going to get Tony Romo numbers, but you were still going to be able to fly private, you know, in and out at these places. Like, that was really important with Peyton, with his children. And then I thought, well, if you pair Eli and Peyton and you do that on Monday night, then you probably have some magic there. But Peyton standing alone could do it. But this allows Eli. Eli's the only guy who could probably poke and jab Peyton Manning live on the air. And, you know, your announcer probably can't, but if you're able to get Eli in there with Peyton, Peyton's going to dissect the game. Eli's going to be in there. You're going to have celebrities in there. I don't know who your host is. You might as well have Cooper Manning, the other brother, in there. He worked for Fox, but maybe you could loan him out and he could be the pseudo host. And this is more of a, come on in, watch the game with us. From what I'm being told, it's like a viewing party. But the analysis is going to be top shelf. Now you wonder, okay, is ESPN bastardizing its Monday night crew with Steve Levy and Brian Griese and Lewis Riddick? I think what they're doing, and they do this with the national title game, with the mega cast, where you have all of these different channels and they're covering the event. You know, the coach's corner, Bill Simmons is able to do this. But I think that's what's going to happen. And it probably takes a little bit of the pressure off the Monday night team because, you know, if you watched Eli and Peyton, maybe you watch for a little while and then you want to watch an actual broadcast of the game and then you may come back. And it might be a good thing for that team because it feels like ESPN has been trying for over two decades to get Monday Night Football right. And now you have Eli and Peyton on the ESPN platform, but not on the actual broadcast. And they're going to do 10 of these games on Monday night. I'm curious to hear how it sounds. But I was also surprised it's only 10 games. But they want to control the schedule. You know, Tony Romo's got to do the whole season here. Peyton's probably like going, hey, I'll do it, but this we want to do this number of games there. And do you go to each city? Is it something where Eli and Peyton can watch a game and they're in New Orleans? At their parents' house. I don't know, but it feels like it's a brilliant business move. Peyton Manning is doing what Shaq is doing, and that is you don't want to get paid for doing something. You want to own a piece of something. When Shaq comes in and does, you know, pizza or the doorbell or the general, Shaq goes, don't pay me. I want a piece of this. And if you think about, he's become a billionaire with these business decisions. And I think other athletes look at this and go, yeah, don't pay me a fee. Give me a piece of the company. And if I own the company, the fact that you want a piece of it, I like that even more. Like, you are actually invested with me, and I like that. But I think what Peyton is doing, he's got the power to be able to do this, and the mothership is already in business with him, and they're going to be doing Monday Night Football. This program brought to you by Simply Safe. Simply Safe has been making people feel safe at home for 15 years now. With Simply Safe, there's always someone there who has your back to keep you safe. Go to simplysafedan.com today. Customize your system. Get a free security camera. 4 days until the Olympics, and there was, I don't know how to describe this, just to be fair to it, but the head of the Olympic Organizing Committee, the Tokyo Olympic Organizing Committee, talked about the possibility of canceling the Olympic Games as more athletes tested positive for COVID-19. Now, he said he couldn't rule it out. Now, when you see the headline, it becomes a little more ominous. It's a little scarier there. But the head of the organizing committee said, we can't predict what will happen with the number of coronavirus cases, so we will continue discussions if there is a spike in cases. We have agreed that based on the coronavirus situation, we will convene 5 party talks again. At this point, the coronavirus cases may rise or fall, so we will think about what we should do when the situation arises. It's just one of those that you just tuck it in a corner in your mind and just go, okay, opening ceremonies coming up on Friday night. Let's see. Anything else we need to mention here before we take a break? Yes, Paulie?
There is actual Aaron Rodgers news. Actual news.
What?
Ish.
What?
Yeah, I would say it is.
Okay. Okay.
I'm about to email it to you.
Okay.
For soaking in purpose.
Okay. All right. Then we'll take a break and we'll discuss that.
You can marinate on that a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
It feels like news.
Okay.
I think it is.
All right. All right.
Backtracking. I feel like McLovin. I said something and I'm not back. No, I think it is.
Okay. Is it news that I, as a journalist, I need to talk about right now? Or do I take a break?
No, I want you to soak it in.
Okay.
Because there's some questions about it.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll come back and talk about the Aaron Rodgers news. Is it news or not? We'll let you be the judge. Yes, Seton.
Aaron Rodgers and his brother just sold a side screen mega cast for football.
Oh, they want to do Monday Night Football as well?
Yeah, they're going to do that. No, we have ours that we're doing.
They're going to compete against the Manning brothers. That's not it, is it, Paulie? Find out.
I didn't just scoop it, did I? Dang it. Sorry.
Find out next. Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 to noon Eastern or 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Dan Patrick Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR. One of my favorite basketball analysts, John Berry, ESPN Radio NBA analyst, former NBA player. He's been on the call throughout the NBA Finals for ESPN Radio, and he'll be on the call tonight, 9 Eastern, Game 6 tipping off in Milwaukee. John, thanks for joining us. Give me the player who has the most pressure on them tonight.
Well, everybody. I mean, it's a knockout game. So everybody on the Suns, obviously. I mean, I know everybody talks about Chris Paul and it's this legacy. I don't get caught up in that. I mean, does it really change what kind of player Chris Paul is going to be looked at if he wins or loses this NBA final in 10 years?
I think so.
Why? He's a Hall of Famer, regardless. What's the difference?
Well, I think he moves up, though, John, if he wins. I've heard this. Well, Nash never won and Stockton never won. You know, then he leapfrogs them. And then
does
they,
he?
This is what analysts tell me. Do I think that Chris Paul is better than John Stockton? I don't. Do I think he's better than Steve Nash? I don't. Does he belong to be in the top 10? Sure. But is he a top 5 because he wins? He's not better than Jason Kidd, in my opinion.
Right, well, so winning a championship makes you better? than them?
I think that's how people validate greatness. You know, John Elway needed to win Super Bowls to now be considered one of the great quarterbacks. Tom Brady's the greatest because he has all these Super Bowls. Is he more talented than Aaron Rodgers or John Elway? No. But if Tim Duncan didn't have any championships, he'd not be a top 15 player, top 20 player.
Yeah, maybe not. But he's going to be the same player to me, whether this happens or not. And I'm not putting this series on squarely on his shoulders. He played great in the first two games, not so great the last three. So it's not on him. Yes, he's had some blunders in his past in big playoff games. But this certainly isn't a series where it's on Chris Paul to win or lose.
I think there's a lot of pressure on all the Phoenix Suns, but I think if you're the Bucks, you got to win tonight. You did win in Phoenix, but this feels like a coronation tonight. There are going to be 60,000 people outside that building tonight, John.
I understand this. And plus the four of us on the radio that have to walk through that if they win. So I do typically cheer for the road team to close out series. It makes it a nice, easy walk home. No, I think you're right. You don't want to go back game seven in Phoenix. No way. And look, Phoenix could easily be up in this series. I thought game four, they completely gave away with their turnovers. They should have won that game. Yeah. They outplayed Milwaukee. And so they could have gone home and had a closeout game in game five. That's not the case. Obviously, they got off to a great start in game five and the game completely flipped. Milwaukee had Monty Williams told me yesterday, the eighth best shooting game in 1,345 playoff games. The eighth best in the history.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that's eighth best.
Yeah.
I mean, So they started that game 9-21. They went 32-45 in the second and third quarter for 79 points. It was amazing. And then Phoenix almost comes back and wins. But I don't think Phoenix is a fractured team. I think they're still a confident group. And if they were to pull this off tonight, I would say that they would win the NBA championship. They would win game seven at home.
Talking to John Barry, he'll be on the call game six tonight, ESPN Radio, tip-off at 9 Eastern. I was talking to Reggie Miller yesterday, and we were talking about Shaq when the Pacers played the Lakers in the NBA Finals in 2000. He shot 18 of 39 from the free throw line.
In the whole series?
No, one game.
In one game?
Shaq was 18 of 39 in game two, and they won. Like, imagine if the Greek Freak did that, John. Like, we go, man, he went 1-for-10 and two air balls. Shaq went 18 of 39.
Wow. And L.A. still won the game?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so are you getting at maybe you try that with Giannis tonight?
Put
him on the line?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, now he is at home where he's probably more comfortable. I don't know the stats per se on his home road splits on what he shoots free throw wise. He had gotten better and obviously not so good in the last game, I believe 4-for-10. But it was a great miss because they got the offensive rebound and Chris Middleton made the free throw to put it out of reach. But I don't know. Is Monty Williams saving this to possibly do it? Because they haven't done it yet.
I know.
Maybe it's a ploy if it gets down to a tight ball game here. You know, but it's got to be after 2 minutes, obviously. So I don't know. I doubt that we see Monty Williams do that.
And when it comes to free throw shooting, and I've talked to former players, and I said, look, if you could shoot it underhand, like your father famously did, and you could make, let's say, 77% of your free throws, and you're maybe a 50% free throw. Like if you said to Giannis, try this, and you go 80%, would players be more likely to do what your dad did? And your dad was one of the greatest of all time. Like, is it easy to teach that style of free throw shooting?
I think he could teach guys with the big hands. I think it's an advantage to do. You know, I've never really messed around with it, but I think if you have really big hands and it's kind of a wrist cock thing where it's not hard to do. But I don't know that guys would do it. I mean, I played with Shaq, you know, in what, 97, whatever it was. And I used to joke with him about it. He's like, I'm not looking like a sissy like that. You know, like, Like, I'm not doing that. That's embarrassing. I'm like, I go, all right, well, what's more embarrassing? Shooting 18 for 39 from the free throw line in a game or doing that? Like, I don't know. If you care enough, I certainly would hope my if I coached a guy, I'd hope he'd want to shoot 80% as opposed to 50%, regardless if he had to put a pink tutu on at the free throw line. If it went in, do it.
Did Shaq practice free throws?
I shot with him every day. Every day we went into free throw, a breakdown of free throws. I was with him 17 out of 20, 18 out of 20, every time. Every time.
And then what happens?
I don't know. Some people don't like to be at that line. I think maybe fatigue it plays a factor if you're in the game. Who knows? I mean, you're the center of attention. I know guys love to be the center of attention in certain areas, but maybe not standing on a free throw line when everybody's just staring at you.
What's the best conversation you ever had during a free throw?
With the shooter or with another guy?
Another guy.
Well, like the guy, like first base when these guys get hits and they go over there and stand. Ah, gosh, I don't know. I mean, it would usually pertain to something that was going on in the game. I mean, it was never like, you know.
Did people say
Davis.
Stuff to you at the when you were at the line?
No. No. I mean, it wasn't like a.
Well, you were pretty good free throw shooter.
No, I didn't. It didn't. Yeah, no. I mean, yeah, guys might say something like, hey, we need this one. Give us this one. Well, yeah, we know he'll give us this one. Like, yeah, whatever. It's like, yeah, sure, I will. It's free points, man. I'm not giving you anything.
Is there any chance Chris Middleton gets factored into the MVP if the Bucks win?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was wondering about that yesterday. Like, if Middleton goes big tonight and Giannis is, you know, okay, what do they do? I mean, I know Giannis's numbers are better. But, you know, quite honestly, Chris Middleton's the go-to guy of the Milwaukee Bucks. Now, I know Drew Holiday came up big in the last ball game, but when they need baskets, Middleton made some shots in that last game. Yeah. The step-back three right in front of their bench.
Yep.
I did the Eastern Finals as well. He had a 23-point quarter, a 20-point quarter. I mean, when this guy gets rolling, he's awfully difficult to stop. So, you know, typically they always go with the big-name guy, right? I mean,
yeah.
So you would think Giannis gets it. But Middleton's been huge. And then Drew Holiday to bounce back after a 4-for-20 game four and play the way he did. Man, and he defensively, he is a monster. I mean, he's giving Chris Paul fits.
But you have the Booker situation, and I don't know if it's too much of a good thing, John, where he's going to get 35 or 40, but is that good for his team, as strange as that may sound?
Well, two straight games over 40, and he's lost them both.
Yeah.
Certainly not his doing, but what Milwaukee's doing, and Mike Boonholzer takes a lot of heat for not being a guy that adjusts and does different things during a game. I think he's done a great job. Is their switching now is causing Phoenix to play one-on-one basketball. And it's either Chris Paul or Devin Booker playing one-on-one. Their assist numbers way down. Their passes per possession way down. And the shot-making has been incredible. What Devin Booker, the shots that he's making to get his numbers, I don't remember many uncontested shots he gets. He is working extremely hard and making unbelievable shots. So, if you're Phoenix, somehow they still shoot 55% in the last game. They still go 13 for 19 from three.
I know.
But you can't expect to play one-on-one basketball and make the kind of shots you're making on a consistent basis. So tonight, you've got to get some ball movement. And Phoenix has not moved the ball. And credit Milwaukee for making them a one-on-one team. And credit Devin Booker for doing what he's doing. But if they continue to play one-on-one and don't get Mikal Bridges and Ayton and other guys, Crowder, involved, I don't think they can win.
He's John Barry, ESPN Radio NBA analyst. You were on the Lakers in 1998.
Something like that. I don't know. I mean, I was on eight different teams. I can't remember years. It's just a little difficult.
Well, no, you guys got swept by Utah that year.
Yeah, we did. We did in the Western Finals.
And Kobe was, what, 19 years of age?
Yeah, second year in the league.
And he took the last shot, didn't he?
No, that was the year before.
Oh.
That was his rookie year.
But what do you?
He didn't play much. I mean, Eddie Jones was the two guard, and Kobe played less than 20 minutes a game in that second year.
But did you see sort of what could be with Kobe, or when did you see that?
100%. Every day in practice when it was game seven. We get ready to scrimmage, right? We're on the second team, and he was going after Eddie Jones every day to show Coach Del Harris, like, no, this is my job. I don't know why this guy started. And, like, literally every day was game seven when we started scrimmaging. I mean, the guy was as driven as any guy I've ever known. Like Michael Jordan, he's as close, and John Smoltz are the three most competitive guys that I've ever met.
John Smoltz?
John Smoltz, as competitive as anybody I've ever met, 100%.
Well, you played against Kobe and you played against Jordan. You've just played golf with John Smoltz, right?
Right. But I'm just saying, he'll do some gambling and will gamble on anything. And he's just, I'm putting him there, except for in Tahoe last week.
When he choked down the, down the stretch there.
Oh, sorry, Johnny.
That's pretty good though with, you know, Kobe, but I'm sure that what was Eddie Jones like when, does he know his days are numbered when he's seeing this, that Kobe's going after him?
I don't know. No, because Eddie was still pretty young. And I think he went to Miami after that and had some all-star seasons. Yeah. So he accepted the challenge. But yeah, everybody kind of knew, like, this kid right here. Oh my gosh. When he arrives, it's going to be hello world, like Tiger, right?
Did Shaq know it?
Shaq knew it, of course.
Because I just wonder about that ego, you know, those egos. And I know it wasn't there yet because Kobe hadn't had success. But could you feel like, you know, there's only one king on the throne here?
You know, no, because I didn't think that Kobe would care. He just wanted to play. And that's all he wanted. And that's all he did. Like, literally, he wouldn't talk on our planes. He would, I believe he wrote a lot of lyrics, rap music. And he would not, he wouldn't join in our reindeer games of cards and all that stuff. Like he would sit by himself, write whatever he was doing. He would watch Michael Jordan interviews. He would never go out in the city we went to. You would never see him. He'd be at practice and we'd play one-on-one after practice. And if I didn't say I'm leaving, he would never leave the gym. No, he wouldn't. Like, I had to say, like, I'm out of here, man. Jesus. It's like we're 2 hours after practice, man. He would never leave.
Wait,
not really.
So he's watching Michael Jordan interviews?
100%. He wanted to be him more than anything in the world and be better. He got close.
Yeah, he's
just
close. Yeah, that's when we, and he wasn't afraid to say that he wants to be Michael Jordan. Whereas LeBron is not Michael Jordan, but Kobe said, look, I want it. I'm going after you. You wear 23, I'm wearing 24. Like
I'm one up on you.
But I loved that he embraced it. He didn't back, because a lot of guys have shied away from it, where Tracy McGrady, Grant Hill, hey, they're the next Michael Jordan. Kobe's like, hey, I'm the next Michael Jordan. And people are like, come on, you're 19. You know, easy here. Then all of a sudden we realized he had somebody that he had footsteps to follow.
He wasn't afraid of that. Yeah, he loved the comparison. I mean, that's all he wanted. I mean, I remember the first time that we played Chicago, when we played him twice, obviously being in the West. And that game at Chicago, I mean, this kid was bouncing off the walls before he got out there. And, you know, the problem was we got our butts handed to us. So he didn't get to match up against Michael very much. But, man, the guy played like it was game seven when we were in there down 25. I mean, he was something.
Did Shaq run onto the court naked at any point during a practice while you were with the Lakers? He did not.
No, I never saw that, thankfully, no.
Okay. Some of his teammates say that he was famous for doing that. Like he'd go out there in just his socks and then he would hug people.
I mean, that guy's great too. It's amazing those two guys, you know, that happened, because Shaq is as good a guy as you ever meet. He's just the biggest kid in the world.
Complete opposites though, right?
Totally. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. Have fun tonight. And so you're rooting for the Suns just so you can get out of the building safely?
That's basically it, yes.
Okay. But one of the 8 or 9 teams you played for was Milwaukee.
Yes. Almost 30 years ago.
Well, they still remember you.
A few people have. Yeah, I do. Welcome back to Milwaukee. It's great.
You should wear your jersey tonight.
I have the ugliest green. Remember the all shades of green
Yes.
down the side?
Yeah.
That's what we were.
Yeah.
Awful. The worst.
I have a Terry Cummings autographed jersey from that year, from the when you guys had those jerseys. So, yeah, Terry
Cummings.
Awesome. Yeah. Have fun tonight. Always great to talk to you. Safe travels there, John.
Thanks.
That's John Barry of the Mothership tonight at 9 Eastern. Those are great stories about Kobe. And you're 19 years of age, and, hey, I'm not getting into games, but I'm going to treat every practice like it's game 7. And then watching Michael Jordan interviews, get mannerisms down, and he certainly did that. Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 to noon Eastern, or 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Dan Patrick Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
Hey, I'm Doug Gottlieb. The podcast is called All Ball. We usually talk all basketball all the time, but it's more about the stories about what made these people love their sport and all the interesting interactions along the way. We talk to coaches. We talk to players. We tell you stories. You download it. You listen to it. I think you'll like it. Listen to All Ball with Doug Gottlieb on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We make way for one of the great executives in TV history, NBC Universal Sports, the Olympics. He also was one of the creators of Saturday Night Live. Oh, by the way, he's Dick Ebersol, who joins us on the program. Dick, good morning. Thanks for joining us. We wanted to talk about 25 years ago this week, Muhammad Ali lit the Olympic torch in Atlanta. And I was curious, the backstory of that, like, how did you keep that secret from everybody, including those who probably worked for you?
Well, it started, Dan, a few days before Christmas in, I guess it would have been, the games were in, what, 96? So it would have been just Christmas week in 95. And I was in Billy Payne's office. He was the head of those games. He'd gotten the rights to the games for Athens, or not Athens, but Atlanta. And he, when asked by me who had he decided would light the cauldron, he said Holyfield. And I said, Billy, I just don't think that's a good idea. I just don't think he really has that stature. I know he's a local guy, but there's somebody who's much better for this. And he said, who? And I said, Muhammad Ali. And he said, in all earnestness, he said, Dick, I just think I'll have a terrible time trying to sell that here in Atlanta. And I said, Billy, it's just not comprehending what Ali is all about at this stage of his life. I think he's probably the most beloved person in the entire world, other than probably the Pope. He's appreciated by young people, by people who are now well beyond their youth, who watched his valiant fight for what he thought was right. He gave up his prime earning years. The sacrifices were enormous. He put everything on the line. And to show you how strong he held his opinions, he sat on those sidelines for several years, losing that money. And in the meantime, he really tested out the court system. And he won a unanimous verdict from a very, very conservative U.S. Supreme Court. I think it was 8-0. He was vindicated, and he went back to fighting again. And Billy said, geez, I still don't think I know enough. And do you remember Lisa Lacks, who worked for us at NBC? She was our primary filmmaker, Dan. And she, I said, I want you to make this film. I called Don Hewitt, the 60 Minutes executive producer, and he had done the most recent interviewer. He'd had somebody from his staff, had been in Cuba about 2 weeks before and done an interview with Ali. And Lisa cut all this stuff together through the ages. And we sent it to Billy. This would have been in the spring of 96. And he watched it, and he got a pretty strong sense of, you know, what this real Ali was all about. But he was still a little reluctant. And at that point, I got off the phone and called Andrew Young, who was a prominent member of the board for the Atlanta Games, the former ambassador to the United Nations, among other things. Big deal in Georgia. And I said, you've got to push Billy over the line. And within a day, he did. And Billy always appreciated that fact. And as Clinton told me the day after the torch lighting, and not the torch lighting, but the cauldron lighting in Atlanta, he said, when Ali appeared, the world heard the loudest hush in human history. Because when he came up over the rim of the stadium and the public saw him, it wasn't initially cheers. It was this kind of enormous kind of sound that was just everywhere. And what a lot of people forget, they spent a fortune building this ramp on the exterior of what became Turner Field so that the athletes could gradually walk up five stories and come up over the rim of the stadium, as opposed to in the past, all Olympic ceremonies, they'd come walking in some gate into the stadium. But here, they just appeared. And when they saw the athletes coming up and then they saw Ali emerge, it was just unbelievable. And as it was, his courage was on display. And I suggest to people, I don't know how often you'll be seen again now. We've just had the anniversary. But watch as he holds that torch to light the arrow, not the arrow, but the thing that looked like a little rocket that was going to shoot up and light the cauldron. And the flames are licking back across his forearms. Yeah. And I kept thinking, how much longer can he hold this? Because it's got to be burning this, the top of his arms. But he did until the thing lit. He was an amazing, amazing character. And I knew him beforehand because of my days in Wide World of Sports at ABC. But I did get to know him better through the years after that. In fact, Susan gave a birthday party for me, my 50th, in 97. And it was in a theater off Broadway. And it was, the theme was This Is Your Life. And they had Costas play the role of, what was his name, Ralph Edwards? Was he the host of This Is Your Life?
Yeah.
And he had a script inside the book, and the voices would go, Dick, I remember the time, blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden out would come like Bill Russell. And Russell, who was and still is a very good friend that goes all the way back to me being a teenage production assistant doing the NBA games while I was still a student at Yale. Russell told the story of the two of us not knowing it or driving up Route 5 in from L.A. to San Francisco, him on his way home to Seattle. I didn't know he was doing this. And I was in a Porsche. I'd been unceremoniously let go by NBC Entertainment at some point before that. So I had decided, I woke up one morning and I said, I'm going to see if I can make it from Beverly Hills to the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco in under 5 hours. Insane. I mean, whatever I was thinking. So I'm going up Route 5 at over 100 miles an hour. And I notice that this bug, this Volkswagen bug, hardtop, it keeps getting closer to me. It's like hanging off the left side of my car, but not quite where I can see the driver. And then I realize I can't see the driver. And then suddenly the thing pulls dead even, and the horn starts beeping, and I look, and Russell has leaned forward from the back seat and looked at me, and he's smiling. I know he's cackling because he doesn't laugh. He cackles. And we pull off of Route 5, and he tells me that he's gone down to pick up this car. He'd always wanted to have a Volkswagen Bug, so he'd removed the front seats and had an oversized seat put in the back of it. And he drove from back there, Dan, and we just stood by the side of the road, and he was here when the Hall of Fame ceremonies took place recently in Connecticut and Massachusetts. He stayed here with Susie and I and his wife and his godson. You know his godson is? Sean Kemp Jr. Remember Sean
Yeah.
Kemp?
Yeah, played his for Seattle. Did Bob Costas know the night of the ceremony, the opening ceremonies with the torch with Ali? Did he know
I never told he or Enberg. And I only had one conversation about it. I had it with somebody else that I don't think you know, so I won't mention their name. I just said, I think these guys are such solid pros that their excitement and their immediate recall of anything that was important about Ali would easily meet the test. And I didn't tell them.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, when you hear the tape even today, they're both extraordinary. I mean,
Enberg is truly surprised, Dick. He is Dick
Enberg.
Yeah,
you got a bunch of oh my's. You got a bunch of oh my's.
Yeah. Famous for his oh my's. Yeah, I was just curious.
Bob's recall was splendid.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you had to have complete trust in them, and rightfully so, that you know they would handle the surprise, but they would also give you the backdrop of what this moment means, that Ali battling Parkinson's. You know, even Janet Evans handing it off to Ali. I forgot about little Janet Evans, the swimmer there.
Yep.
Before I let you go, can I want to ask one Saturday Night Live question.
Sure.
Do you remember Eddie Murphy's audition or the reaction to it?
No, I don't. And here's the interesting thing. When I went back to the show about 2 years after Lorne left the first time, we'd started the show together. I left after a bunch of years. He stayed for probably five or six longer. And then he left, and the person who succeeded him just didn't know what to do, and the show rapidly fell apart. Lorne was asked to go back. He still said no. He didn't like Silverman, nor did I. But Brandon Tartikoff, who was my best friend from college years and until the day he died, he talked me into it. And I came back. I did not know Eddie other than from being amazed at just how funny he was in the few shows I'd watched in that period, because the show wasn't very good other than him. And when I got there, it took me about 1 week to decide that the quickest way to at least send the message out that the show was back, I constructed the show that the first three acts, which is basically 11:30 to midnight, that Eddie would be in every one of them, and they would be ones that he had conceived and worked on with these two writers who were his partners in crime, comedy crime, all the way until today. They've written all his movies, David Sheffield and Barry Blaustein. And
he was 19.
Revived him.
He was 19.
Yeah, well,
at
he
the
was
time.
18 when I got there. He was 18 when I got there.
Wow.
And he carried the show. And I'll tell you one story that you'll just love. So I'm back on the show for several months, maybe six, and the security people have called upstairs at NBC and said that, what's the name of the famous children's show? Mr. Rogers was downstairs and wanted to see me. So they brought him upstairs, and he sat with me, and he just told me how disappointed he was that Eddie was doing Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood. He thought it was too tough on the show. And I said, no, it's as loving as you can get. It's him adapting it to the circumstances of what a young black kid would fully understand. And it probably was already a fan of Mr. Rogers. And he just didn't want to accept it. So I walked him down the hall to a room where Eddie was with his two writers, and they talked to him for a while. He was charmed by it, but he came back to my office and he still said, I still wish I couldn't do it anymore, but I just decided to keep airing it. And it continued to be one of the two or three things the audiences wanted to watch the most. And it was a lovely caricature.
Did you try to get Mr. Rogers on Saturday Night Live with Eddie?
But the fact was, he didn't want Mr. Rogers to air anymore, so there was no way on earth that he was also going to accept an invitation to come do the show. So I never made the offer because he was really disappointed that I wasn't just ending it there and then with him in my office.
Hey, Dick, it's great to talk to you as always. I hope you're doing well. My best to Susan and the family, and thank you again.
You too. You're welcome.
Thank you. That's Dick Ebersol, TV executive, senior advisor for NBC Universal Sports, the Olympics, former chairman of NBC Sports, once my boss there at NBC. It's one of those where when he holds court, and he's got a lot of stories to tell. But going back, and Paulie said, do you realize Costas didn't know that Muhammad Ali was going to light the torch? And I said, I can't imagine that Bob, being the perfectionist that he is, would allow that to happen without at least having a sense of the magnitude of this. But, you know, what Dick Ebersol was trying to do is he wanted it to be a secret, and he wanted the announcers to have the same reaction. And Paulie's done this to me before. He goes, look, if I find out something, do you want to know it or would you rather react, you know, normally or naturally? And I said, you know, that really depends. I want to make sure that if I can add something to it or I need to do research to add something to it. Yeah, Paul.
One that stands out about whatever the year was that Brett Favre retired from the Packers or left the Packers, Jay Glazer called in, texted in and said, I've got a bomb. I've got a monster. And we put Jay on hold and I told you to put Jay on without you knowing what Jay had to report. And so when you heard Jay Glazer say Brett Favre is going to announce his retirement tomorrow, you heard it the same time ever all our listeners did. And I thought it was a cool that way.
Yeah, but if I'm hosting the Olympics, I would like to know a little bit more. But, I mean, Bob is such a professional, and Dick Enberg, rest his soul. You know, you got the over-the-top reaction from Dick Enberg with the oh my, and Bob giving you the backdrop on Muhammad Ali. And the fact that he's up there, and when you realize he's shaking because he has Parkinson's, I worry, even I'm watching it, I know how it ends, and he can only use one hand, and those flames are coming up his forearm. But he had created such goodwill by 1996 that if you would have said to him in 1968 or 69 or 70, you know, one day you're going to light the Olympic torch, the flame, the cauldron, he probably would have said you're crazy. Because I think when Ali got back from winning the gold medal in Rome, he threw his medal into the river in Louisville. And I think there was, you know, a racial situation in Rome. And he had won the gold medal and he came home and he threw his gold medal away. Let's take a break. Hope you enjoyed that. Might have been a little bit out of left field, but just remembering that back. And also Eddie Murphy. If you want to talk about going from 0 to 60, when people become a overnight sensation, Eddie Murphy became an overnight sensation, like a true overnight sensation. He went, it wasn't 0 to 60, it was 0 to 100. And he might have started in October, and by December, he's on magazine covers. He was that big a deal back then.